Talk given Saturday, 4th February, 1978. We all use this word mind. What do we mean by the word? What is mind? We talk of a great mind, a little mind, a petty mind, a noble mind. We talk of an evil mind, a pure mind, and so forth. But what precisely do we mean by this word mind? If we look deeply into ourselves and examine how we are using this word mind, we are more than likely to notice that there is a sort of a thing consciousness in us, in relationship to that word mind. When we converse about mind, we often use the phrase, this thing called mind. In other words, the word mind is associated in our thoughts as if it were an entity, something limited, something which can be defined even if vaguely. We have ideas about the nature of the mind. And if you look at those ideas, you will again see that we talk about mind as if it were an entity, as if almost it were an organ, an organism similar to the body and consisting of separate organs inside it. It is curious how we misuse that word mind. Those of us who are specially interested in some of the inner teachings which are the origin of the Semitic religions, or the teachings which are the origin of the religions of India and China, we will find that the word mind is associated with what philosophically we call the absolute, the indefinable, the immeasurable, the illimitable. And yet we will proceed to talk about it afterwards in terms which are applicable in the context of the measurable, the limited, that which can be described. This is the absurdity which characterizes our immature psyches. Now I'm introducing the word psyche quite deliberately. We talk of my mind, his mind, her mind, the child's mind. There is no such thing as my mind or your mind. But there is, quite definitely, your psyche, my psyche. If you look through the literature of the centuries in all the cultures of the world, you will find that they all agree that in the living human being there are non-material processes going on which we call mental processes. We call them mental in the English language because the word is derived from the Latin mens, mentis, meaning mind. They use the word mind. The great philosophers like Plato, Aristotle, and others in the Western world, and also the great teachers and philosophers in India and so on, they had their own distinctions with regard to the grades of the mind. For instance, one of the best known is the Greek word nous. Nous, meaning, this is how I translate it, not intuition, but unerring insight. That aspect of our mental functioning, which makes no mistake whatsoever in seeing truth, in seeing the actuality as it is. Now, in India they used the word buddhi, a word which has baffled many scholars, not only European Western scholars who have been conditioned by Greek teaching, but also Indian scholars themselves. And the word buddhi has been translated as intellect. It has been translated as intuition, as that aspect of our mental functioning which is of a subtler and a profounder nature than our ordinary intellectual processes, because of the activity of which we acquire knowledge. And yet, this sort of use of the word mind gives rise to considerable confusion. It has given rise. Now, I must accept responsibility for these statements myself. I myself, as you know, most of you, if not all of you, because you've heard me say this, I like to differentiate between mind as it functions in each of us as a living human individual and mind in its reality, in its actuality. Therefore, what I am suggesting is just this very briefly. We now know not only through intuitive, if you like, perception, through that which comes to us as truth in the profoundest states of consciousness, we now know that the creative power which is coterminous with creative action in eternity, mind you, not space-time, but in eternity, enables the emergence of cosmos to take place. Now this cosmos, this one total reality, includes everything. We now know, thanks above all to the advances of modern science and mathematics, that the rigid and distinction between the material world and the immaterial world no longer exists. We know definitely about the interconvertibility of what we commonly and legitimately call material objects, material particles and so forth, with energy. In other words, pure energy in itself, concretized in expression, is what we call the material world, solid, liquid, gaseous. Other than that, there is this great field of various types of radiation with various frequencies. Also, other than what we commonly experience as solidity, liquidity, gaseousness, because we are constituted as we are, there is that which defeats all solidity. The solid substance is composed, as we say, of countless atoms, each of which is a little world in itself, a subatomic world, the laws of which contradict the laws of the macroscopic world of solid, liquid, and gaseous substances. But they all emerge as the result of this creative action in eternity, of creative, the primordial creative energy, which is unknown, unknowable by the brain, not investigatable by science, simply because it lies in the context of that which is totally beyond all experimental research or mathematical analysis. You see? Now, this creative action in eternity, I suggest we may regard as the active expression of this primordial creative energy. The active expression. Therefore, it itself, mind itself, this is what I like to call mind in its ultimate essence, ultimate for me as far as I can go. See, this itself is universal. It never began, it never ends. That's why I say action in eternity. It is indestructible. It remains unknown, unknowable as such. But this primordial creative energy, being the supreme, being the absolute, is so utterly beyond us to grasp. This brings into being that which we can begin to understand, which we can deal with in terms of our own limited consciousness, which acts analytically and in terms of separateness. It splits up the whole, stains the white radiance of eternity, to use Shelley's wonderful line. It stains the white radiance of eternity. But it stains it not in the sense of making it evil or besmirching it in any way, but by enabling the wonderful beauty and order of this great creative power to manifest itself in countless forms, which are the manifestation of the, we can now only use ordinary human words, the transcendent wisdom and beauty and goodness and perfection which characterizes this great creative process. So now this is mind. This primordial energy, in its functioning as action in eternity, which enables cosmos to emerge. Now you see, if we call that mind, we cannot use this almost blasphemous adjective in that context, my mind. You might as well say, this here is my space which I'm fencing round and declaring to be my property in perpetuity, which I'll hand down to my heirs forever and ever. It would be as nonsensical and absurd as that. But now consider, this primordial creative energy gives rise to what you and I, in our experience, in our limited context, call the solid, the liquid, the gaseous. This body, this material body, is made up of solids, liquids, gases, and so on. And other energies also, like heat and so on, which we need not a detail at the moment. But this material body is the concretest expression of creative primordial energy. Mind, which is one of the subtlest expressions of this same creative, primordial creative energy, interacting with this, which is also the product of energy, produces in our lives all our processes, which we call mental processes, thought, feeling, and speech. Speech is a mental process. So what we have been accustomed to call mind is actually, as far as that manifestation of it goes, a material thing. It's one of the very interesting points in connection with Indian teachings, that they always have said, that the discursive mind and the discursive mental process, which is the talking process in the brain, is material. This is not spiritual. They call it a sixth sense. And they lay down the usual five senses, sight, touch, hearing, taste, etc. You see, the usual five senses and discursive thinking, which means talking either silently or aloud, you see, as the sixth sense. Discursive mental process. Now, this discursive mental process is there fundamentally because of our faculty of speech. And our faculty of speech is one which consists of a whole system of symbolical sounds making limited, meaningful patterns for our daily life process and our daily life activity. You see? And this is the psychical part of us. But what is its concretest root? It's the brain and the nervous system, the activity of the ductless glands, and the interaction of the living psychophysical organism with the environment. Now try and get this very clearly. Our psychical life is rooted in our particular brain, and the activity, the ordinary electrochemical processes of our own ductless glands. So you see, all human beings function differently, slightly differently from each other. Not only physically, purely physically, materially, but psychically too. Now, this psychical part of us can legitimately be regarded as my psyche, your psyche, his psyche, her psyche. It is this psychical part which is conditioned by the actual state of perfection, health, or imperfection and ill health of the body, the material body to start with. If the fetus in the womb is insufficiently oxygenated, for instance, the brain power, as we call it, of that child will be less than the well-oxygenated one, and so on and so on. Scientists are finding all this out now. You see? So, that is the fundamental conditioning force, the nature of the material body itself right from the start, from the moment the ovum is fertilized. Then there is the conditioning influence all the way through of the environment, of the people around us, our parents, our nurses, our family, our friends, and the conditioning of our socio-cultural heritage, which molds the manner in which the discursive mental processes will proceed. So we can talk of my psyche, and it is my psyche which is ill, which is ignorant, which has resource, which is brilliant or silly or whatever it is. You know, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Yajnavalkya, the great teacher, says one amongst so many extraordinary and significant things. Man is made up of everything. And he means man not only generically as mankind, but also as individual men and women. So now, if we make this distinction between psyche, which is your own psyche, which is specific to you, and mind, the universal reality, then we can go far deeper and far more accurately into the significances and the implications of all the teachings concerned with the living of the religious life. It's important to understand this. You know that wonderful saying in the Dhammapada, the saying of the Buddha himself, strive, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. As far as my little knowledge goes, I don't think in the past they made this kind of clear distinction between psyche and mind. Again, I take responsibility for this distinction. It's my invention, if you like. You see, but I have found it really, it has come to me through over 60 years of grappling with this problem. Literally 60 years. You see, and it has, I found it helpful. Helpful, that's all. Don't lay it down as this is the truth. You discover for yourself whether it is true or not. Now, purify the mind. They didn't say purify the psyche. The word psyche has come in through the Greek use of the word psyche. But they too didn't quite make this distinction. They had, Judaic tradition has the idea of nefesh, the animal soul, ruah, the intellectual principle, and neshama, that aspect in us, the most spiritual, as they call it, which is directly the spark of the Supreme, and through which Yahweh and man meet, neshama. You see, Zarathustrianism has similar distinctions. But in our day and age, you may find that this way of regarding psyche and mind is truly helpful. So now, purify the mind. And he meant purify that aspect of the psychophysical organism, what we are now calling the psyche. Purify the psyche. You see? Bear this in mind. Now you see how difficult it is to talk? Bear this in mind. It is the form of talking which we cannot avoid. Mind in its reality cannot be purified, therefore. You can purify the atmosphere. You can't purify space. space contains solids, liquids, gases, not as a box contains anything, but it actually interpenetrates that which it contains. Now, mind, similarly, holds within itself the totality, the entire totality, holds it within itself, but also is interfused with it, interpenetrates it. And this, because it is absolute, because it is transcendent, exercises no compulsion. Freedom in its supreme and ultimate sense lies in the context of transcendence. You can't measure, you cannot characterize it. It has no characteristics. This is the extraordinary thing. You see, if one can sort of respond to it from within oneself, then one is as if opening the doors and windows to the influx into us of this context of transcendence, which has another or many other dimensions of being and consciousness lying completely beyond our ken. And it is this which characterizes the coming to perfect fruition, the becoming clean and perfect of our own psyche. When that happens, and the psyche is empty of all flaws, of all ill, of dust and dirt and confusions and distortions and so forth, then pure mind functions freely. By pure I mean absolute mind functions freely through this purified psyche. That, if you like, is one of the ways of understanding, just one of the ways of understanding man's divine destiny. He, on this planet, is the instrument for the manifestation of the ultimate that man can ever reach. God or Brahman or Atma or Truth or the Absolute Wisdom, or call it what you like, all words are futile, and yet all those words can be suggestive if our receptive responsive sensitivity is open to mind. Our receptive responsive sensitivity, that is to say, which the sensitivity which characterizes every living human organism, is that something through which pure absolute mind can make contact, like neshama of the Judaic tradition, like immortal spirit, if you like, of theistic traditions, like Brahman or Atma of Indian teachings, and so on. This receptive responsive sensitivity, which is more than just the psychical manifestation through mental processes in our own daily life. It's important, it really is very important, with our own psyche and mental processes quiet, to get the sense of this, because with the first awakening of the sense of this, the sense of transcendence itself awakens in us. And then, that, when that has awakened to a sufficient degree of intensity, that is our teacher all along the line towards the full fruition possible to us in our lifetime. No one can teach you to let transcendence realize itself through you. Who teaches this body after birth to grow in the way it grows and has grown? Could you or I at any stage have said, this body must be 6 feet high, it must have a 48-inch chest, it must have such and such terrific muscles, or such and such marvelous, alluring graces of movement and all the rest of it? Can we lay it down? Oh no, this mysterious energy, this wonderful expression of the primordial creative energy makes this body grow as it has grown from birth to maturity. So too, we cannot command transcendence. It does everything, and it does everything by not doing anything in our sense of the word. It does it all without premeditation, without planning, without desiring or anything. This is the meaning of creative action in eternity. It is acausal. It is consequenceless in its own context of transcendence. There is no reward or punishment, no joy or delight in our sense of the word, or grief or remorse in our sense of the word. These are the meanings of absoluteness. See? Now, we talk about the unity of all life, the unity of mankind. Grand words which we use. Does our actual life at all conform to those marvelous phrases? Is there any predator so destructive as man? Is there any deliberately cruel, evilly acting being or creature on this planet as man? He has proved it to the hilt through thousands of years. And yet he is the one who has this divine potentiality within him, which none of the other creatures have, to his extent. No other creature can be free of itself, of its limited selfness. We, by virtue of that very selfness, by virtue of the most devilish power that can be possessed by any creature, by virtue of that and the terrible consequences that it brings, can awaken to the whole realm of duality and its conflict, and finally emerge out of it in perfect purity and marvel and beauty, so that the individual being has become the egoless being, that is, devoid of egoism, freed of that type of self-consciousness which draws everything to self and blocks that everything, fixes it, and thereby produces conflict and the misery of the world. So, let us come back to this, the unity of mankind, the unity of the whole universe. His word, man's word, universe, is a perfectly correct word. It is a universe, not a multiverse in which the different verses, if I may say so, are unrelated or are in eternal conflict. No. It is a universe. This is the guarantee of the coming to fruition of this primordial creative energy in terms of the perfect harmony between cosmos as we experience it and chaos as we could realize it if we are completely open and wide awake. These are tremendous things, perhaps the beginnings of a new ontology for our age and time. But no religious teaching, although the religious teachers confined themselves to a supreme moral teaching primarily, and just a little bit more than that, no religious teaching is free or can be free of an implied metaphysic, an implied ontology. So now, what can we do here and now, imperfect as we are, towards allowing this sense that we do have, this feeling that we do have, towards letting that unity of mankind, the unity of the universe, be a matter of fact, actuality within us, so that we are at home in this unity. And what we call being at home is not a house divided against itself, is not a place of quarrel and misunderstanding and the spoiling of that which in itself is utterly pure and beautiful beyond all human imagination. What can we do? You all know we have practiced several times through these years, and it is now February 1978, which marks 16 years since our group started. You all know what we have called this earth meditation. This is not true meditation in the real sense, but it is a step, perhaps a living step. Something which is the result of actual growth within our own being. Not a mechanical performance of a routine method laid down by so-called teachers who say that we must conform to this. You and I are living beings. We are not mechanical engines. The mechanical engine by itself will just lie static and rust and collect dust. The living creature is utterly different from that. The mechanical engine has no withinness, so that of its own volition, its own vision, and its own sweet accord can cooperate and be in harmony and interact rightly with its environment. But living creatures, including the animal world, can do that. So you see, we must bear that difference in mind. Because our meditative processes, so-called, are mechanical conformation, they are fruitless. They produce certain fixations in the mind, give us pleasant feelings, and insofar as they are pleasant, we say, ah, I'm succeeding. But there will always come a point where the circumstance will be so provocative that, like the game of snakes and ladders, you're right near the top rung and then zoot, down you are at the bottom with a mighty bump. And the higher you have climbed, the more rueful is the consequence with the fall. But that which grows, has grown, has flowered out, there is no such thing as a fall possible to it. You see, these are the differences. But people don't think, they just run mechanically for comfort, for this, that, or the other, and say, oh, I'm in such a mess, I do want some help. Ah, that's it, thank you so much, I'll go and do this. Well, all right, you do it for a time, it's all right. And then it is not. Why? Because what you have got is a palliative, a pill, a dope, a tranquilizer. You'll wake up out of that tranquilizer with much less capital than you had before. The poorer for it. Although perhaps you may grow in worldly wisdom. We must grant that also. Now, let us just practice this earth meditation in this living sense. We have just a few moments. You remember what we have done in the past with it? Just let the body be perfectly at ease, and the ease for the living body means an elastic ease, not floppiness. Let the rhythm of the breath be established, well established. This is your life rhythm, and it puts you in tune with the life rhythm of the whole world. Now in this state, be aware of the fact that everyone around us is part and parcel of us as we are part and parcel of them. There is one mankind composed of many individual men and women. And here at this moment, this hour in our lives, we as a group are engaged in this particular activity. And at this hour, along the whole of the longitude of London, people from the north to the south pole are engaged in somewhat similar activities. They have perhaps just passed tea time and so forth. Just let the psyche be quiet as it encompasses this with open arms. So, according to the country in which one lives and the customs and ways of the country, along this longitude, people are doing all kinds of things. Man is made up of everything. And if we move eastwards, we are moving towards those who have already done that which we shall be doing at a later hour of the day. And so, if the brain will make a lightning dash right round the globe, at this particular moment, everything that is thought and felt, spoken and done by mankind, is actually happening now. Everything, good, bad, indifferent, evil, wonderful, sublime, terrible, everything is happening now. Which means that the single moment of the earth, of the whole planet, because we must include the animal world and the plant world and the very earth itself, everything is happening now in all the kingdoms of nature. And so the single moment of the earth is the equivalent of our full 24-hour life process. All 24 hours and all the activities within them are comprised within the single moment of the earth. Let the psyche feel this immensity. Feel it very quietly, calmly. Let the brain help to hold within the compass of its consciousness the totality of the living process. Now hold it without aversion, without attachment, without exercising choice. The primordial creative energy, call it God or Godhead or whatever you please, exercises no choice whatsoever. A strange thing to say, but very true. It happens in the universal process. this universal process is the totality which is the supreme, which is transcendence. Transcendence neither accepts nor rejects anything. It is there. And it is a changing process, because in all the limited contexts of manifestation, the variety of manifestation, there is specific limited purpose, namely the coming to fruition of that particular kind of manifestation. Now, if you can hold this quietly and calmly, when you are practicing by yourself, you will feel through your receptive, responsive sensitivity the touch of the transcendent, the touch of totality. And it brings immense power and strength with it. Leave that power alone. Be utterly free of all desire in any shape or form to use that power. Be without aversion, without attachment, without choice. Just be at one with it. That will open the gates and the doors and the windows. In fact, all the walls of this little house and its very foundations will disappear. And that totality, that transcendence will be you, freely you, functioning through you, which is one of the supreme miracles that each of us as the individual being can experience. And it is this which affects the environment as well as oneself, who is the apparatus merely for all this. For the true good of oneself and the world. So the Buddha's words, cease to do evil. Be free of aversion, attachment and choice and desire therefore. Strive to do good. There is no necessity to strive. The striving lies in being so mindfully aware that there is no aversion, attachment, desire, and choice. And this spells that perfect purification of the psyche, because of which mind in its totality can function freely through you. I call this the earth meditation because we start with just where we are. On this planet, with this material body itself, and we at one ourselves, the supreme and the true atonement, if you like, we at one ourselves with this totality, by means of which selfness is completely gone. That's why I have called it the earth meditation. There are many other things associated with it. All the subtle and different forms which the primordial creative energy manifests itself, they will all function through you without your knowing it. But you must be pure and perfectly mindful in order to be an apparatus, an instrument, a living instrument, which will not disrupt because of the energies liberated.